to everybody out there a happy Sunday morning. Someone had messaged me on Patreon, and I responded, and I haven't heard anything back, and I'll say it here on air. They said, where can I get, if you have a copy of the Country Slayer song, I want to get that. Where can I get that? I was like, I do actually have it. If you email me, I'll send you an MP3. So if you guys email me, booking@thisisrevolutionpodcast.com, I have no problem emailing you guys the openers, these opening songs that I have. Getting that out of the way, this episode is from our very fun Thursday episode we did called The Politics of Yoga. So, of course, if you're listening to this, you're like, what the hell were these guys talking about with yoga? And it was a very interesting story. When we were interviewing Corey Pine, I don't remember if it was on camera or off camera, he was talking about being in India and being so, like, malnourished. I think he lost some hair. Like, hair was falling out. Teeth were yellowing. And we were like, what the hell are you talking about? And he talked about how his wife was in India studying, or not studying, teaching the politics of yoga. And we were like, what? That sounds awesome. So right away, me, Gene Bajlan, made sure he kept in contact with Corey and made sure that he stayed in contact with Corey, and we got his wife's information, and asked her if she wanted to be on the show, and she was like, yeah, you know, I heard my husband giggling for a couple hours, so I'm sure it'll be a good time. And there definitely was on and off air giggling on the show. It was one of the more fun shows I've done. I mean, it was a very serious topic we're talking about. We're talking about fascism, the Modi administration. In the first hour, we hint at it a very little bit towards the end of the show, the demonetization that happened in India, where the larger paper notes that were very commonly used, literally overnight, I think within 6 hours, were just gone. And Professor Southoff actually brought it into context that it literally happened the day that Trump was elected. And although the Trump election wasn't the catalyst for this move, I do find it a bit coincidental, because the groundwork for the demonetization move was laid down by the Obama administration in 2012, and then, of course, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So even years before Modi even comes to power, this was in the works, and it had devastating, deadly effects for the poor rural parts of India. And if you know, India is a very rural country, very agrarian society. So there were mass suicides, of course, crazy long lines, you know. So we get into this in the bonus patron half of the show a lot more. In the first part of the show, we definitely give you kind of a history of yoga. I wouldn't say a history of Narendra Modi, but we definitely talk about his involvement of using yoga as a soft power, if you will. Move promoting yogis in positions of power with very fascistic elements. I think when we think of Hinduism in the West, people don't think of fascism, but we definitely get into that conversation in the first half of the show. So very good show. I enjoyed it. If you want to watch these shows as they're happening, there's only one. Well, there's multiple ways to do it. You can follow us on social media wherever you're listening to this show. There are links in the description to all our social media. The best way is probably via YouTube. YouTube.com/ThisIsRevolutionPodcast. Every Tuesday and Thursday at 6 p.m. Pacific time. And the free show, we call it the free show because we go as long as we want to go. And if you're familiar with our Norman Finkelstein episode, then you know we can go 3.5 hours. And that is the episode, I will say. Glenn Greenwald actually tweeted it out, and he said someone told him to listen to that, and they sent it to him, and he's like, I'm not listening to this. It's 3.5 hours long. And they said, when you listen to it, you're going to wish it was longer. And Greenwald responded, yes, I agree. So say what you will about Glenn Greenwald. He is a fan of the long form podcast. When we get yelled at by Norman Finkelstein, we actually didn't get yelled at by Norman Finkelstein, but it was a fun show. This was a very fun show. It was educational and a good time. If you want to be a patron and listen to the bonus half, there's links in the description wherever you listen to the show as well. But very quickly, I will tell you it is patreon.com/BitterLakePresents. You get all the bonus content. You get the Pascal Robert Mau Mau Hour. Movie night. It's well worth it. Oh! I know what that sound is. It means it's time for me to shut up. So enjoy the show, Dr. Patricia Southoff, and the politics of yoga. I am out. Good evening, and welcome to another edition of This is Revolution Podcast. And since we have a packed house tonight, and we want to fit as much as we can in the first hour, I'm just going to get right down to it. Let me introduce my co-host, my homie, my dog, the baddest man in Miami, Florida, Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles.
that picture when it's blown up on the bigger screen is mildly disturbing. Just the dude's face.
You are the one who chose the background image.
It was me. And he is everyone's favorite professor in the entire state of Missouri. Not just in the small town that he's in the entire state. Mean Gene Bajlon.
Greetings, everybody. It's lovely to be with you all on this fantastic Thursday night. I have to say, I'm probably not everybody's favorite professor at this very moment in time, as I've just marked a bunch of essays. So I'm probably going to be not everybody's favorite professor for at least the coming week. Actually, there were some good essays. Great to see you, Pascal. You're looking very smooth and sophisticated this evening in that nice outfit you have, that beautiful emerald green.
Thank you for the commentary.
Some people are remarking about the mobile bar that is behind me. So as you can see, I'm not in the normal location that I've been doing the show in. I no longer am in that location. For the time being, this is where the show is going to be, and there is a bar behind me, but I do not drink, and have never drank. But enough with that. Our final host, part of the foreign policy crew, he's somewhere in a bunker in the great Northwest. We love him. Sometimes you guys love to hate him. The resident villain of the show, with the insignia that no one knows exactly what it means. Deep State Cuba.
I am online.
it's the sigil of the Illuminati.
He's sitting there and he looks like he's about to drone strike someone.
Or suck blood from someone's neck.
He did both. He just did both.
We have to a happy birthday to say today, do we not?
Yes, it's Summer's birthday, and I will sing the Summer because we do love Summer. Summer being super significant other.
Happy birthday, Summer. Happy birthday, Summer. And happy birthday.
Just for that, no drone strike.
You saved.
I've removed my finger from the button.
Kuba looks like a mid-level administrator on the Death Star.
I filled out all my reports correctly. I passed all the necessary certifications. I don't understand why I'm not Death Ray operator by now, or at least assistant Death Ray operator.
It's because you weren't in the right eating club at Yale.
You're right. You're right. I failed my my skull and bones initiation, and as a result, I'm going to top off at lieutenant commander.
That's the meanest shit I've ever heard you say. That he looks like a middle manager at the Death Star. Fucking bitching.
That was the chat.
Yeah, I mean, you think that's an insult, but like, I get to put planets on the list. And Planet Oakland right now, kind of looking good.
Right now, I'm like an hour away from Planet Oakland. You totally hit it. I won't even feel a tremor. But since I did promise we were going to... Jesus taking shots. I do have to say this. My dad has these little shot glasses. These little paper shot glasses. And my son was here the other day. And I couldn't find his little cup. So I poured him milk in a little shot glass. So he was taking milk shots.
Tasty.
I have to get a picture of that so you guys know that it's real. But let us play the video for what we're going to talk about today. A very interesting subject. There's always a background image that gets you ready for what we're going to talk about. And let's get ready for today's show with this very fun intro video. One of the few intro videos I actually had a good time making.
Relax. I'm going to move the energy from your thighs to your buttocks now.
Hey, is my back straight?
Face the wall!
Hello. I was wondering if yoga can help my back, because it hurts like all... Huh?
Let me tell you a story. Once I was like you, skeptical, nearsighted, paunchy. Then I met a special friend. This glorious friend took me to places I thought I'd never...
Excuse me, but is this one of those stories where this special friend of yours turns out to be yoga?
So parents in America in the 1990s were adorable. A lot of them never got the memo that the satanic panic of the 80s was fake and there never were any secret cabals of Satanists infiltrating society. So they were still keeping an eye out for the secret enemies in culture that would lead their kids astray. This included music, movies, TV shows, or anything else that might secretly be steering their children towards Satan. And it's in this time period that the folks in Alabama started looking at some very serious issues. In 1993, a policy was passed prohibiting meditation and hypnosis and other practices that could be considered tied to the hippy-dippy New Age movement from happening in school. And lumped in with this was yoga. The reason? Because it was associated with Hinduism. Alabama parents were worried that yoga was going to turn their kids Hindu.
To many in the West, the practice of yoga is largely a secular act seen as part of maintaining a healthy lifestyle and good posture. Certainly, some are keenly aware of its origins as a spiritual practice from the Indian subcontinent. Indeed, elements on the Christian right have condemned yoga as a form of worship of the Hindu pantheon. However, it is not only amongst conservative Christians that yoga is seen as controversial. In yoga's homeland, India, the history and meaning of the practice is a topic of heated debate. In this episode, what is yoga? What is its political meaning? And why has it become a lightning rod of controversy in Indian politics? We'll ask these questions and more. This is Revolution.
I'm telling you, man, adorable. Of course, a quarter of a century has passed since then, and nowadays people consider yoga about as religious as a spin class. So why is it still banned? Well, the document that brought all this to light has been taken down by the current state superintendent, and he says he's not going to be putting it back up. So while the yoga ban is still on the books, I don't think anyone is actually enforcing it. And further policies have watered down yoga so much that PE teachers are actually free to teach yoga as long as they don't call it yoga. There's even this course guide for PE electives that recommends teaching stretching with an asterisk. And at the bottom of the page, the asterisk is explained as, quote, course may not be called yoga. However, only yoga technique poses slash exercises and stretches may be included in the content. Alabama.
So I would love to see what PE class in Alabama looks like, knowing that now that they can't call it yoga, but they can teach yoga.
Or talk about critical race theory.
Or play dodgeball. Dodgeball was on the list. No dodgeball.
Alabama sounds like a very not fun place, but I can probably should tell some behind a paywall stories about some Alabama fun I've had. But enough with that. Let's introduce our guest. Hold on. Dr. Patricia Southoff is a assistant lecturer at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada, in the Department of History, Classics, and Religion. She teaches courses on Indian and Pan-Asian religious traditions and the history of India. And she's going to tell us today about the history of yoga. Please welcome Dr. Patricia Southoff.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for agreeing to come on. We had your husband on, and we had a very good time shooting the shit with him about why I personally hate Silicon Valley.
He's the one to talk to about that, yeah.
He literally wrote the book on it.
Yes.
That was a great episode. Patricia, I want to thank you for coming on our show and giving us this wonderful debriefing on yoga, the BJP, India, and all those things. Before we get there, in the context of kind of my cynical left politics, I've always viewed yoga as this kind of like, you know, liberal, hippie, spirituality kind of, you know, thing that, you know, all the, you know, gentrifiers are into, so on and so forth. And it's easy to look at it in that context and divorce it from the fact that this is a phenomenon that exists in an actual country that has an actual history. Can you for our audience, actually explain the real history of yoga, define what it is, and also I'd like you to explain why does it have that kind of hippy dippy touchy friendly connotation as well, and how did that happen?
All right, goodness, that's a lot. Okay, so yoga, well, it depends on how we're defining yoga. Yoga as exercise and as, yeah, colonial construction of stretching goes back to about the 1930s. There's a lot of gymnastics that were brought into it, like British military exercises were brought in. And so that's kind of where we get this gentrified yoga. There are yoga postures that are in texts that go back a little bit farther, but they don't tend to look like the ones that would happen at your local yoga studio today. And then if we're talking about yoga as a philosophy, then yes, it goes back. We're not quite sure how far. It's hard to sometimes date things in India. But the sort of the main text is the Yoga Sutras, and that was composed probably around the 2nd to 4th century of the Common Era. And that's the text that gets read a lot in yoga classes now, although its importance sort of varied over the years. So the word yoga itself just means like to yoke. It's cognate with that word. So it's like to join two things. And so it has this connotation of union. And in Hindu philosophy and Buddhist philosophy, it's about uniting with the deity or the universe rather than uniting with good posture or whatnot. So that kind of shifted at some point to include this very physical practice that wasn't always there. That's the very short version of that story.
So in terms of yoga as a historical term, it's kind of analogous to a term like tevhid in Sufism, unity with God. It's not specifically tied to this exercise practice. So when you talk about this exercise practice and this version that's created in the 30s, is that created by British colonials in India, sort of mixing those things up? Or is it an invented tradition by Indian nationalists? Or how does the yoga version, it's a philosophy, but then it becomes associated with this physical movement. How does that, who does that?
It's got this kind of back and forth. So there were these practices that were going on. There was gymnastics. There's a long tradition in India and in Indian yoga, the philosophy of, you know, maintaining your body and doing a lot of bodily practices. So then this exercise movement kind of gets brought into it in India, and then it gets exported, and then it gets re-imported into India. So it's always, there's always a back and forth happening with yoga in India. So, you know, people in India who, like, International Day of Yoga looks very much like a Western yoga class because it's taken some of those things back from the West and reincorporated them into the practice.
Okay.
So right now, in terms of the practice of yoga in India, how much of it is an extension of this indigenous tradition, this kind of pre-global yoga boom movement, and right, how much of it comes out of the reimportation?
That's really hard to say. There's not a lot of people in India do this like stretching kind of yoga that we in, you know, the United States think of as yoga, but, you know, part of yoga is also practice. So just Hindu practice in general can be called yoga because your idea is to unify yourself with the deity. So pujas or rituals can be considered yoga. Meditation can be considered yoga. So everybody kind of defines yoga differently. It's one of the interesting things about it. You know, you go to any town and you're going to get a different answer of what yoga is, because it's a very personal thing, but it also does have, you know, a history that people are aware of and stories that go along with it. The idea that Shiva is the first yogi, you know, then makes yoga, you know, from time immemorial. But he's not stretching, he's just meditating. But he's considered the first yogi by doing that.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you is that at what time in Indian history, or has it always been considered that yoga is in a key organic part of the Hindu spiritual mantra overall? Is it actually in an organic functional part of the Hindu spiritual mantra, or is that something that comes along with it being exported kind of as a cultural product of India?
It comes along pretty early, but there's Buddhist yoga and there's Jain yoga. So any religious group in India can do yoga and have their own version of yoga. But it's been part of what we now call Hinduism for so long that it is considered a pretty integral part. It shows up in most religious texts, have at least a section on something that they call yoga, and what that is can look very different depending on the text that you're reading.
So basically what you're telling us then, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the term yoga itself is pretty vague and is used in different contexts, even in different religious traditions in the Indian subcontinent. It is something to do with spiritual unity. It's a kind of spiritual version of religious practice. Something that, you know, again, as I come out of the Islamic tradition, something like a Sufi-esque kind of practice.
Or is it just like an analog of prayer?
Yeah. But then in the modern era, when we talk about, when we're talking about the yoga we know in the West, that is basically a modern cultural product created under the conditions of British colonialism and with Western influence and things like that.
Yes. Yeah. And it's not just analogous to prayer because it's a certain kind of prayer. So it's a prayer for a certain thing, for that unity, rather than, it's not prayer like, oh, you know, I really hope I pass this test. It's
not
prayer.
Just talking to God. It's pursuing a kind of unity with the divine.
Yes.
So, Pascal.
One of the questions I want to ask is to put this question of the politicization of yoga and your experiences in teaching in India with the current agenda of the regime in India, which is the Modi regime and the BJP and the current political party. Can you explain for our audience who is not particularly familiar with the current politics of India, what the BJP is as a political party, who Modi is, and why exactly are people, particularly some on the left or just even liberals, particularly concerned with his administration? And we're going to tie this also in terms of his promotion of yoga. Can you put that particularly in context for our audience?
Yeah, so Modi kind of rose to prominence in Gujarat, which is in Western India. And he was very big in the movement to create this thing called the Ram Temple, or the Ayodhya Temple. So this is a temple that is thought to be the birthplace of Ram, who's a mythical, maybe semi-mythical, semi-historical character from one of the epics. The problem is that they want to build this temple on a mosque. And he was seminal in rising people up to help destroy this mosque. And then he was the chief minister of Gujarat. And during his time there, there were quite a few incidents of deadly violence against Muslims. So a lot of the Muslim community calls him the Butcher of Gujarat. So he got his start really in an anti-Islamic fashion and group. And he's been part of this movement for a very long time. So this group has now risen to power. And the BJP is really connected to a group called the RSS, which is a sort of military arm of the BJP. And they're very much modeled on Nazis. They don't deny that. Like, it's part of the literature, is that, you know, these Nazis were doing great things organizing groups. So they have children's groups and all the kinds of things that Nazi Germany was doing to provide propaganda. And Modi's been part of this for a very long time. And a lot of the people that he's working with and who he's promoting are also calling for violence, sometimes outright, sometimes through dog whistles, against non-Hindu communities.
Would you consider that Modi is a Hindu version of the reactionary nationalist turn we've seen in global leaders from Front National in France to Viktor Orban in Hungary to Boris Johnson in England. In other words, is he just an Indian
in Poland?
In Poland, yeah, yeah. Is he an Indian manifestation of this kind of right, new right-wing politics, but with the cultural accoutrement of Hinduism and religious accoutrement of Hinduism and a cultural accoutrement of India in it? Would you say that's a fair description of Modi?
Oh yeah, I think he exemplifies that. He's very much a cult of personality. When you're driving through the streets in India, you'll just see these huge billboards just of Modi. They don't have any words or anything on it. It's just Modi staring at you. So he's very much got a cult of personality and is more, I think, like Donald Trump, really, than even some of his other people, with the ecstaticism that his followers have for him.
Would you say, I mean, you highlighted the connections with fascism, and I kind of have a two-part question. Would you say that, you know, the term fascism is very, you know, complex, and, you know, there's a lot of debate about it, but it seems to me, and this is just my personal opinion, the closest thing that we have in the modern world to fascism, not only in rhetoric, but also in the kind of political violence that is being unleashed in the country, is from Modi, right? So would you call Modi a fascist? That would be my first question. And my second question is, why is yoga becoming an issue for the BJP? You know, like, is this part of their kind of fascist propaganda? What do they, you know, what is the relationship between yoga and this kind of right-wing, reactionary nationalist, or even fascistic political movement?
On the question of whether Modi's a fascist or not, I, rather than really state whether I think he is or not, I would have you look at what happens to anyone who does call him a fascist. So if someone calls him a fascist on Twitter, they generally get death threats. I know a woman whose five-year-old child has gotten rape threats. It can be a really scary and dangerous thing to describe him that way. And so I would actually rather not define him in those terms, because they're so malleable that I don't want to be misunderstood. But I think he has fascist tendencies? Absolutely. Do I think his group is tied to a fascist movement? Like, there is a fascist element to Modi and Hindutva, definitely. But I think to just call it fascism is problematic, because it is an Indian thing. And again, you know, this is putting this foreign word onto this leader that, you know, it's important to notice how this developed internally as well as with the colonial and outside influence.
To what turn that around, I don't mean to interrupt, but I'm curious as to what's distinctively Indian about Modi.
Well, Modi's got this myth there's a lot very Indian about Modi. There's a myth of him being the chai seller who then froze up and became the prime minister. So his hagiography is very, you know, involved with Indian stories. He takes on the look of an ascetic. He, like, during his first election campaign, people were surprised to find out that he was married, because he's never been seen with his wife. He got married very young and then left her in her village, and they've just been married for a very long time.
Like, but he had to go pick up a pack of cigarettes?
Kind of. He presents himself as like this ascetic, and that's a big part of what sells him, I think, is that, yeah, he doesn't have any kind of westernized thing. He's a Hindu. He's a wise Hindu man. He's been growing his beard out lots of people have been growing their beard out during COVID, but, you know, he's really getting the, like, I'm an old wise man beard going on, which is also part of that mythology that he's building about himself.
So he exudes an intentional veneer of Hindu authenticity in terms of his garb, his accoutrement, his dress, and everything else. He's not a guy you're going to be seeing in a Brooks Brothers suit and British wingtips, in other words.
No, but there is an amazing suit that he wore once that someone made for him that had pinstripes on it, and up close, the pinstripes were his name. It was amazing.
Well, let's get more back into kind of Gene's question here, is that what is the utility of yoga to the Modi regime, and why are they so exercised about exporting or claiming yoga as this authentic Indian product? Everyone's into it. This is so wonderful. This is amazing. What is that about? Is that just kind of like a kind of cultural product that he's trying to claim for his movement, or does it have a deeper significance?
Well, I think it's the soft power movement, right? To say, look at this wonderful gift that India has given to the world. We gave you this lovely yoga thing that can help your body and your mind. And that's also, of course, going to drive tourism, right? People want to come to India to study yoga because they think it's more authentic, or, you know, just this Orientalist notion that India is so spiritual. And he's really selling that. And that is very much part of it. So on the one hand, he'll tell people, you know, anyone can do yoga. And on the other hand, he'll turn around and say, you know, yoga is Hindu. It's for Hindus by Hindus. And then kind of discredit anyone else doing it inauthentically. So he likes to have it both ways.
And to that, I'd like you to kind of expand on your own story. We've been, you know, bombarding you with all these questions. But one question we haven't asked you is, you sent us some reading materials. Thank you very much. I actually did some more research that we're going to get into in the bonus half about Bill Gates and his involvement with the demonetization in India. But you went to India to teach the history of yoga. And tell us your story, if you will. You have time. Tell us the long version. Throw some jokes in if you like. Anecdotes.
Throw some trauma in there. So
it was a very moving story to the point where, as Pascal was reading it, he's like, man, this yoga politics thing is really cool. And we can't wait to have the show. So I was shocked. Reading your story, I was shocked.
It's pretty wild. So in 2016, I was about to finish my PhD, and I got a job teaching at a startup university in rural India. And I thought, this sounds like an amazing adventure. Why wouldn't I do that? So I packed up my family and we moved to rural India. So when I say rural India, I mean, this is a state, it was in Bihar, which is a state in eastern India that people don't really go to. Even people in India don't really go there. It's a state where people move away from, but not really go to. And then we were about 3 hours south of the airport. So the only white people in town were
y'all
university people. Yeah, like my husband, me, and then a few of my colleagues. So there was maybe like 5-6 white folks. And so it was pretty obvious who was with the university. We had a lot of Indian staff as well and faculty. And so, yeah, so I moved there and I'm excited about it. It's really cool. My department's just starting. So we get to plan the whole curriculum. And it's an MA program at a university founded in part by Amartya Sen, right? So there's lots of good selling points here. Mm-hmm. But at this point, you know, there is a little bit of question. Sen has resigned as chancellor. He's a little worried about academic freedom, but, you know, we think we can start this from scratch. We can do whatever we want. So
worried at all about academic freedom?
A little, but I mean, I'm always worried about academic freedom, no matter where in the world I am. So
gotcha.
Probably not as much as I should have been. So we start this department and it's great. We've got 25 students from all over the place, India, South America, all over Asia, just tons of just a very diverse group of students. Really wonderful. And first semester goes okay. There's some, you know, issues with food and housing and, you know, the kind of things you expect.
Like more than issues, like you guys are having some serious nutritional problems there.
Yes. So there were a lot of problems. There was no doctor available. And yeah, we were having nutritional issues, which some people kind of blamed on my being white from the West. Right. Yes, exactly. Like, oh, you can't handle spicy white food.
You can say white. And totally right. Cooper, is it okay for her to say white?
I'll give her a pass on this one.
Gotcha.
Well, but not just being white, but also just being a foreigner. Right. And this idea that like the foreigners can't handle the food and these, you know, ridiculous foreigners. And
better.
So really less about my skin tone than just my being an outsider. because even like the Bengalis were not treated as Indians at times. They were sometimes treated as foreigners as well.
Because they're all communists.
Oh, yes. I was told I couldn't ride my bicycle through town because of Maoists. And I thought, I don't think that the Maoists are going to steal my bicycle in this town of 20,000 people. But whatever. Yeah, so the first semester goes okay. Second, right at the end of the first semester, they fire the vice chancellor and they bring in a Hindu nationalist as the new chancellor. And eventually they bring in a Hindu nationalist as the vice chancellor. As this starts to happen, I basically think my academic freedom is toast. You know, like I'm not staying here much longer. So I decided to teach a class called the History and Politics of Yoga, partially because no one was paying attention to what we were doing because of all the chaos of, you know, putting all these people in power. So they didn't care what we were doing. They were going to fire us all anyway. So I decided to teach this class and we had a great time. It was really fun. It was a small class, but you know, we talked a lot and we had practitioners, we had non-practitioners. I mean, it's kind of a joke. We had, you know, Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, Catholics, like we had everybody in this class and it was fine. It was great. I left at the end of the semester as one of the last people to leave. And I took everything I had with me because I was pretty sure they weren't going to invite me back. To my surprise, they did invite me back. I got a letter inviting me back and I thought, okay, great. I'm not coming. But so I didn't answer it because I wasn't quite sure how to answer it. And then I woke up in the middle of the night one night to an email from a journalist asking what I thought of this tweet that was sent out that was like, you know, at Nalanda, they taught this class on the politics of yoga and it's been abolished. And this was the first I'd heard there was a problem with my class. So I talked to the journalist and that kind of set off a whole thing where I ended up not getting paid. I got lots of threats on the internet. Basically they just kind of decided to use me to demonstrate why they had to purge this university of its foreign influence without ever looking at the syllabus or even getting the name of the class right. And, you know, the class, it was the history and politics of yoga, but that also involved things like yoga being advanced because a certain king, you know, gave money for an ashram. And the way that yoga was, during the Mughal Empire, yoga was, you know, depicted in art and in court art. And there was money given to yogis at court, right? So the Mughal Empire was not just saying that, oh, Hindus are bad and trying to abolish yoga, they were actually really putting yoga up. But teaching anything good about the Mughal Empire is not allowed anyway. And yeah, so then I got a letter just stating that, thank you for your service. We won't be needing you again. And then after I talked to the journalist, that got them very angry. They tried to order me to apologize, which obviously I didn't do. There was consequences. I don't know what those consequences are. I imagine that I'll have a difficult time getting another visa to go back to India. I can't ever work there again because they won't in India because they won't release the paperwork that I would need to get another job. So they just kind of shut me out of India. I was already back in the States at that time though, so I did at least feel safe. If my face had been on the front of the newspaper while I was in India, I'm not sure I would have made it out. It would have been very terrifying. That's kind of the short version.
In your course, did you actually make any statements or were any comments you made about the administration, the government? Do you have any academic publications that made commentary about the government or the administration that would have put you on a watch list of any type?
Not really. I did teach a little bit about the most populous state in India is Uttar Pradesh. And the chief minister, which is like the governor, is a guy named Yogi Adityanath. And he is a yogi, right? He always wears the orange robes. He's the main priest at a temple. And then he's also a politician. And he's said things like, anyone who doesn't do the sun salutation should drown in the sea. And that's referring to non-Hindus. And yeah, his rhetoric has been very strong. One of the first things that he did was to shut down all of the butcher shops in the state, which cut off the economic supply to a lot of the Muslim community. And so we did talk about those things as actions, but I mean, it was in the front page of the newspaper. We were talking about it on campus anyway. So there's really nothing in the class that people weren't kind of aware of. I was just asking them to really pay attention to that in the context of historical and global yoga.
Is putting people like that in power, when Modi puts people like that in power, does that help push the, what you call the soft power of yoga, by putting these yogis who the West sees as like peaceful people that want to meditate and stretch?
That's a good question. I'm not sure, because I know so much about Adityanath that I don't really know how he's perceived. I'm not sure that he really is perceived, other than, yeah, maybe seeing his image.
I mean, some of the statements that you talked about him making, and that I actually read him making about every mosque needs to have Hindu symbols in it. And, you know, also you mentioning closing the butcher shops. Wow.
I mean, this is
not trying to hide it, is he? But under the guise of being a yogi, again, I think us from the West don't view yoga and Hindu as anything fascist whatsoever.
Right. Well, and he's perpetuating that myth of Hinduism as vegetarianism. That is a very certain kind of vegetarianism that is not all over. Vegetarianism is really, you know, one class of people in India really can afford to have other people cook them vegetarian food. Pretty much everybody else in India, people do eat fish. In South India, people eat beef all the time. Hindus eat beef. It's not really a big deal in certain parts of South India. In North India, it's more of a big deal, but there's still meat that's eaten, chicken. And so Adityanath, by doing this, is really, I think if any influence he has on the West is to perpetuate this idea of a vegetarian Hindu India.
So if one thing that you brought up in the context of Modi, and I think we picked it up here too, is that there's a cultivation of a certain kind of image of yoga, of India, of Indian spirituality, of Hinduism in general, that is common among, let's say, the patchouli set in the West, or even picked up by people like Gwyneth Paltrow through Goop, and it becomes part of the wellness movement among many well-to-do Westerners. And then there's what Hinduism and Hindutva mean politically within India. How consciously do you think Modi is trying to reinforce those two different meanings and to kind of present a sanitized, kinder, gentler version of Hinduism abroad?
Well, there's definitely a movement to associate Hindutva with Hinduism, and to say that anything that is anti-Hindutva, and Hindutva being like Hinduness, nationalism, this idea that India should be a Hindu state, is, sorry, I lost my train of thought for a second. Oh, so that anything against Hindutva is Hindophobia. And they're really trying to, and a lot of that comes from the West. A lot of money that gets raised by these nationalist organizations comes straight from down the street from where all of us are. They raise tons of money from North America for things like building this temple on a mosque and doing all of these things. So I think it's a strong effort to define Hinduism both inside India and outside India, and defining Hinduism outside of India as something that's tied to India as a place, something that India has power over, and something that is innately Indian.
Would it be fair to draw, because what you're describing sounds to me a little like Modi and the advocates of Hindutva are trying to appropriate the tactics of Israeli hawks and hardcore Zionists, in which a criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic prima facie. So similarly, you can't go after Modi without being bigoted against Hindus.
Exactly.
It also seems, well, you know, a lot of the things you're talking about seem, you know, remind me of Erdogan in Turkey and the, you know, the way that Turkey is presented as a place, as a holiday resort, but there's also like a, you know, stricter internal sort of nationalization of religion, which I think is a kind, is what Hindutva is, which is tying religion and nation together. But what I quite find quite striking, I wonder what your thoughts are on this, is, you know, when we have an image of when we see an imam or somebody dressed in traditional Islamic garb, there is a kind of like visceral anti-Islam, you know, frankly, Islamophobic reaction by many people in the West, who see these people as being inherently reactionary because, you know, because Muslims are associated, have very negative association. That doesn't apply with, you know, we don't, in the West, people do not see militant Hinduism or militant Buddhism as we see in places like Myanmar and Sri Lanka, right? It seems that people in the West are not as alive to the realities of these religious reactionary movements in the West, partly because of the existence of this domesticated kind of like deep or secular version of religious practice that gives people you know, that has these religious practices, these inverted commas spiritual practices that are turned into the wellness movement. How much do you think these perceptions in the West you know, impact on the development of this movement in India?
Oh, tons, because people don't know. People come to India and they spend money and don't really think about, you know, who they're giving money to or where that money's going. They're really just searching for, yeah, this like peaceful spiritual existence. And yeah, this idea, I was going to bring up Myanmar myself because, yeah, you have a Buddhist militant movement, and my students are always shocked, you know, well, but Buddhism doesn't have violence. And I'm like, yeah, everybody has violence. They're people. The ideal is not to have violence. The ideal is ahimsa. But the reason you have that ideal is because there's violence. You know, Gandhi was shot by a Hindu nationalist. There's people who don't want him on the money. And, you know, so I think, but people think, you know, oh, Gandhi's sort of like this peaceful man who's the embodiment of Hinduism. And then somebody like Yogi Bhajan or Osho comes over and they're automatically assumed to be benevolent and then maybe turn out not to be so benevolent. And then everyone's surprised, as if that is a rarity rather than something that clearly is happening a lot, because a lot of these gurus have been accused of sexual misconduct and violence. But we still treat it as, you know, there's one bad guru over here and this one bad guru over here, rather than thinking about whether this has any kind of cultural context.
I actually have a kind of follow-up question. It's a little bit of a tangent. It's like, what's your take on, and you may not have an answer to this, what's your take on Tulsi Gabbard's relationship with all these people?
Oh my God. Tulsi Gabbard gives me such a headache. Yeah, I think she's a total Hindu nationalist. She supports them. She's given them money. She's given them press. People in India don't know that she's not Indian. They assume because she's Hindu that she's Indian. And they also don't know that she is a white guru. I think a lot of people don't know she has a white guru. So she's very much involved in this sort of colonial Hindu project in a way that people just give her credit for just, you know, being a nice, peaceful Hindu lady.
When you say colonial Hindu, do you mean imposed by colonialism on Hindus, or Hindus doing colonialism to, in this case, Hawaii?
Oh, no, in this case, I mean, like, gentrified Hinduism, I guess, would be a better term than colonialized Hinduism. But, I mean, it is white people colonizing Hinduism and gentrifying.
Or Hindu missionaries being successful among white people.
I mean, there's some of that, but those traditions tend to look quite different. And, you know, most Hindus would say that you have to be born a Hindu. You can't convert. So the idea of converting to Hinduism is kind of a new idea, and mm-hmm. and very much, you know, goes along with this idea of converting people to Christianity or whatever. Yeah. So, and I think she's completely homophobic, Islamophobic. I don't know if she's homophobic or not.
Wasn't she a little homophobic for a minute, and then she like pushed back on
Well, I think she, yeah, she was, she was, she was, she said she changed her mind on on being a gay hater. But I think, you know, and this is why I get mad at some people on the left who are bigging up Tulsi Gabbard. She has some of the most repulsive anti-Muslim politics out there, and she made her name basically going on Fox News whining that Barack Obama would not say radical Islamic terrorism. So any dumbass, excuse my French, on the left who is promoting Tulsi Gabbard as some kind of freaking warrior against imperialism is frankly a moron, right? Is a moron. I get a bit angry about Tulsi Gabbard because like her politics, her association with Hindu fascism, and also her history of anti-Muslim thing. Oh, but you know, of course, she supports Assad. Why does she support Assad? Because Assad is bombing the crap out of Sunni Muslims. So, you know, like, I don't have any time for Tulsi Gabbard apologetics. So I'm glad you could clarify that point about her associations with Hindu fascism.
Yeah, and she's hung out with Modi. She's been pictured with Modi. And, you know, there's a lot of Bollywood stars, too, that hang out with Modi. And this is one of his ways of soft power, right? He was at Priyanka Jonas's wedding. And she said things like, oh, you know, I support our Indian troops while they're, like, bombing the shit out of Pakistan or oppressing people in Kashmir or whatever it is that they're doing.
She recently admitted that she was on a special assignment in Africa discussing, you know, various types of military types of activities, all under the guise of AFRICOM in the continent, without disclosing the fact that the African continent is currently being militarized under the exiges of the United States. So she, I've always found it.
Tulsi Gabbard said this, or the actress Priya?
Tulsi Gabbard was tweeting.
Oh, you got to make that shit clear because you just cut me in. I'm thinking that was like, why was she there talking about Tulsi, Africa?
Priyanka Jonas also has got some very sketchy connections with, you know, the Lord's Resistance Army. Is it true?
Isn't she going to be on the Activist, that new TV show?
I believe she is going to be a host for the Activist, along with Usher and someone else. I have no idea who they are.
I like Usher.
I mean, Usher discovered Justin Bieber, so
yeah, he's
like, a percentage of Canada's GDP.
That's right. That's why my trash gets picked up.
One of the questions that I wanted to ask, though, is that in the face of this kind of reactionary Indian politics that we're talking about right now, with this kind of fusion of Hindu Veda and Hinduism with this really right-wing kind of movement, at the same time, India is being marketed as this kind of like international capitalist kind of interesting place to go. We have all of these tech gurus and
our friends against China with the whole Indo-Pacific rebranding of East Asian security policy.
Yes, exactly. A bulwark against China. Yet at the same time, all of these international one percenters are embracing India as a kind of our friend in the the Asian realm. No one is trying to check or question Modi and his rather violent, brutal past. Do you think that part of his timing and his proximity to this politics allows him to basically get away with even more egregious politics while he's serving the interests of international capital?
Oh, yeah. There was, I don't think it was a mistake at all when he demonetized the currency. It was the night before Trump got elected. And all of a sudden, no one cared what was happening in anywhere else in the world. Journalists I knew lost jobs because people just said, Trump got elected. We can't write about the rest of the world now. And so I think, yeah, he used those 4 years of people not paying attention to what he was doing to do some really horrific things, including like cutting the internet from Kashmir for like 18 months. And it's still not back totally. So yeah, I think he's definitely snuck some of those things under the radar. But yes, while at the same time being like, come to India, it's beautiful. And it is beautiful and it is interesting and it's multicultural and it's got this incredible history. But he's sort of using that Orientalist trope to sell India to the West, while at the same time saying we got
entrepreneurs.
Yeah, and at the same time saying like we need to keep these foreign elements out. But come see the Taj Mahal.
Well, the Chinese are teaching them a lesson with sticks up in the Himalayas, at least. So, you know, they're beating the Indian army up with sticks.
Another question I wanted to ask you, Patricia, is the Indian left strong or of any note that they're challenging, or maybe Muslim opposition to Modi? What are the politics of opposition to the Modi regime? What do they look like?
Pick up on that. Has Modi been able to deliver enough development and economic uplift to have his own constituency that to push back against opposition?
He has the advantage of having an incredibly weak and corrupt left. It's all, you know, family, dynasties, and so he doesn't have a lot of, there's no good unified opposition. So he doesn't really have to worry about that. I mean, there's so many parties that when he won the prime ministership, he won it with like a third of the vote or something ridiculously low. I think it was about a third of the vote. It was definitely way less than half. Because there's so many different parties and so much corruption and such a weak opposition that he just kind of skated right in. So in various places, you get a strong opposition to the BJP, but that's very localized. On a country level, it's just a hot mess.
Because where were those big uprisings they had in India, those big farmer strikes?
Oh, those are still going on. A lot of them are outside of Delhi, so they're outside of the capital.
Is that where there's a good left movement, or is that just literally workers uniting, if you will?
That is literally workers uniting. There's a lot of the Sikh population is involved in those. And so, like, even here in Canada, I see a lot. We have a large Sikh population here in Edmonton. And so I see, you know, flyers and signs on cars that are in, you know, support of the farmers' protests. But yeah, it's definitely a workers' movement. It's not a politically organized movement at all.
And for my knowledge, in Britain, for example, Sikhs are very much involved with sort of left politics and the labor movement. Wasn't there a Sikh minister of defense in Canada as well? Didn't you?
Until recent, he was in the first Trudeau government.
The leader of the NDP is a Sikh.
Yes.
He'll be losing that election on Monday.
But there's also a substantial Sikh separatist movement in Canada.
Khalistan, baby.
And one of the commenters, Storm McCollum, I think, pointed out that there's a lot of diaspora money coming into the right wing of both particular groups like the Sikh separatists or the Hindutva right in India. To what extent does the overseas community play a role in kind of shaping Indian politics? In which way do they trend? Is left wing and right wing?
They play a massive role, especially in the right wing, because the right wing is so organized and they're very organized on like an issue, right? So you don't have to, if you're a diaspora Hindu and you see that they're trying to build a temple, you know, you might give money to that and you might not know, they might not tell you where that temple is, right? It's just like, oh, we need a temple to Ram, donate so that we can build this beautiful temple, you know, for the poor Indians back home. And they work on some of those Orientalist things of like, you know, you're helping these people back home who can't afford it. And yeah, and it's just like issue driven, right? So, I mean, it doesn't seem bad. Oh, build a temple. Yeah, give a couple bucks to that. But then if you know that that temple is being built on a destroyed mosque, you might not want to give that money. But they're maybe not telling people that. And, but they're also, you know, being upfront as well and saying, we have to build this thing. We have to take this land back that is ours. It's the birthplace of our God.
Land back.
Land back, yeah. Baby.
So, to what extent do you think that there's a certain, and I say this as a Polish immigrant to Canada myself, that with immigrants and the children of immigrants, there's an anxiety about authenticity, about belonging sufficiently to your heritage, respecting your heritage enough, being Hindu enough, being Polish enough, being Sikh enough. Do you think that that's one of the ways in which you can pick up diaspora communities for the right wing?
For sure. I get a lot of students, you know, I teach Introduction to Eastern Religions, and I always say, you know, first day of class, hi, I'm obviously a white woman who's not a part of these traditions. But I get a lot of diaspora children, right? Children of immigrants or grandchildren of immigrants who want to know more about that place back home. And when I tell them something like karma came into Hinduism, probably from Buddhism, they sometimes get really upset because it's not what they've heard. And they have heard these sort of more nationalistic things. And then here's this white lady telling them that that's the wrong history.
Do they call you an Orientalist? They go, oh.
I haven't really been called an Orientalist. I've been called a Hindu-phobe. I've been asked if I moved to India to have some kind of authentic experience. And
Columbusing, like, Columbusing.
What is an authentic experience? You know, like, no, I moved there because it sounded cool and an adventure, and my UK visa is about to expire. I need a job.
An authentic Indian experience is working in a village as a sharecropper. That's the authentic Indian experience.
Or driving an Uber in New York.
Hey, I think you guys are doing a racism.
Not as bad as the accent I was doing earlier today, Pascal.
Jean Bajlan, for those of you that don't know, had me and Pascal literally in tears with the accent he was doing that we will not talk about who it was and what he was.
Not even going to identify it.
I'll tell Kuba off air, but it was the funniest shit. Kuba misses a lot of these phone calls because he's too good for us. And he's also making sure all the TPS reports are on the faxes in the Death Star.
Darth Vader, even all the minor Darths get a little upset if the TPS reports are around.
You do look like a character from the East German Stasi Museum in Berlin.
Yeah, For Me, The Lives of Others was an aspirational movie. He's got the headphones and everything.
That's what's doing it for me, is the headphones. And like, is this man listening to me and writing this down? He can tell my neighbors to narc me out later, or what's happening?
I have Lil Darth Kuba.
That's his rap name. Darth. Well, it seems like we need to go to the fun half.
We are at an hour. If you are a patron, the link should be up. If it's not up, I know I'll be getting a bunch of messages on why my mask doesn't have the link up. That being said,
Do we even ask Patricia if she's able to come join us?
We did it beforehand. We did something we normally don't do, which is put people on the spot.
Well, but I was already prepared because my husband did this show a couple weeks ago, so I already knew that I was going to get bombarded with an hour or two, so it's all good.
So guys, I'll be putting the link, the YouTube link, in the Discord as well. So if you come to the Discord, you can also find.
Oh, I never thought to do that because there's so much that I do.
Hey,
I don't do that so well.
I'm here to back you up. You send me that YouTube link and I'll put it in the Discord for everybody.
And that's friendship.
I should have bought the soundboard. I'm kind of angry I didn't do it. I was
Patricia,
like,
I'd like to thank you for coming on our show. I hope you enjoyed your participation and be willing to come on again to talk other more controversial subjects that might anger various people for whatever reason possible, who knows, but still be informative.
My Twitter hasn't blown up with death threats, so I'll be back.
Well, for the bonus half conversation, we definitely want to talk more about the demonetization that happened in India. Let's talk about Bill Gates's and the Gates Foundation and Obama and USAID's role in the demonetization in India as well. So if you guys want to do that, become a patron, patreon.com/bitterlakepresents. Until then, we're going to play the outro stuff. Good night.